Good evening, and welcome to a one-night stand with the big bands. Tonight on our one-night stand with the big bands, part two of Artie Shaw, the man and the music, brought to you by the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut, with authentic early American reproductions to beautify your home, and by Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, Bristol, offering fun for the whole family since 1846. About a month ago, on part one of our program on Artie Shaw, the man and the music, we traced his early life as young Arthur Arshawski. Born in 1910 on the Lower East Side of New York City and raised in New Haven, Connecticut. He attacked the sax and later the clarinet with a passion and was playing with the best musicians in the New Haven area while still in his early teens. By the time Artie Shaw was 16, he'd left Connecticut, and just months later, he was with the nationally known Irving Aaronson Commanders. Then he became a network staff musician and learned arranging. In 1935, Artie Shaw put together the first of some 10 different bands he was to lead in the next 18 years. First with strings and a Dixieland jazz approach. Then Art Shaw and his new music. New meaning without a string section. But the band still wasn't successful until 1938. And when success came, it hit with all the subtlety of a tidal wave. And Artie Shaw was to become leader of one of the most musically perfect and fabulously successful bands of them all.
Jeepers creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Gosh, y'all, get up, how'd they get so lit up? Gosh, y'all, get up, how'd they get that size? Golly gee, when you turn those heaters on, woe is me, got to put my cheetahs on. Jeepers creepers, where'd you get those beepers? Oh, those weavers, how they hypnotize. Where'd you get those eyes?
With a vocal by Tony Pastor, that was Artie Shaw's orchestra with Jeepers Creepers. Well, if we were to name Artie Shaw's key to success, it would probably be his perfectionism. Shaw chose only the best men to accompany him, so he consequently had one of the finest groups of musicians ever assembled. He was a maestro who upheld a strict degree of integrity in his music and insisted on the ultimate in performance. This same standard of perfection was the greatest asset of a man who preceded Shaw by over a century. That man was Lambert Hitchcock. Hitchcock also insisted on superb performance in design and workmanship. As a result, the original Hitchcock craftsman produced a line of masterfully decorated furniture with the simple elegance that was to become a classic American style. To this day, Hitchcock's legacy of quality design and manufacturing has been preserved. You can see his exquisite line of furniture at the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut. The showroom displays hundreds of authentic early American reproductions in a variety of lovely colors and finishes. The traditional Hitchcock beauty has been maintained, yet adapted to contemporary needs. Hitchcock, a legend in American craftsmanship. The Hitchcock Retail Showroom is open Monday through Saturday, 9 till 5, Wednesday evenings till 9. It took several weeks before we could fit our WTIC interview into Artie Shaw's very busy schedule. It was well worth the wait. Once we did get together in his beautiful apartment on the 22nd floor of a large apartment building on West 58th Street in Manhattan near Fifth Avenue, we sat down and talked to the tape recorders for some 2 hours on a wide variety of subjects. And many of Artie Shaw's answers will be presented here on our program tonight. Now, Tony Pastor, the man who opened this evening's presentation with Jeepers Creepers, a vocal on that, also opened up one of the great doors of success for the Shaw Band back in 1938 with Indian Love Call. Let's pick it up then, Artie, with that year and your band. What instruments comprised a band then? Four saxophones,
that is two altos, two tenors, three trombones. No, I'm sorry, it was first three trumpets and two trombones.
Yes.
And four rhythm. Mm-hmm. The reason for that was that if you had to play a stock orchestration, that was what they were orchestrated for. Then later, I had the idea of adding a third trombone. As a matter of fact, the first record made with that was Begin the Begin. The idea was to make a choir out of trombones as well as trumpets, and three fills out a triad, you know. I mean, now it's four and five of each. But two, you just get a duo, and that doesn't sound very good to a trained ear. And I would sketch out, for example, some of those marvelous saxophone course. I say marvelous because I hear them once in a while to this day. Nobody's ever done much better with a four saxophone choir.
I can listen with my own inexperienced ear and hear a sax chorus and know whether that was the Artie Shaw Band or any other band.
Yeah, it was all alone. That stood by itself, absolutely. Yes. Well, it stood by itself because what I was doing, as I said earlier, I was doing me. I was writing what I knew I should do, not what anybody else should do. Therefore, it had an original sound. But if I listened to a saxophone chorus on a record like, say, Lover Come Back to Me, or I Surrender Dear, or Out of Nowhere, or any of those where we use the four reeds doing a whole chorus or the first 16 and the last eight, man, that nobody's ever done anything better than that. And I don't mean to sound unduly immodest, and I certainly don't mean to make invidious comparisons, but just as it is said, and with good reason, that what Bach did, you can't do better. You can only go around that or go something somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Well, what that band was doing in its way, you can't do better. There was no better. I mean, we worked like fanatics. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you're going to take that band and listen to a record such as I've told you about, nobody in this world can do that better. That's a nice feeling to have. It's taken me many years to understand that I did at least do that. I left some kind of a meager footprint in the sands of time. And that's mine. I mean, I did the best I could, and it was the best anybody could.
At about the same time, you had left the Brunswick Record Company, and you were with RCA Victor. You went to the Bluebird label, and you mentioned Begin the Begin, and I guess that was the first side that you turned out, wasn't it?
Well, no, you made a big, giant leap. I was with Brunswick for a while. I made a lot of records with them. We tried everything. Nothing was working. Nothing took off. There was no rapport between me and the record-buying public at that point. So at a certain point, I decided it was a waste of time. I mean, I would have liked to continue because they paid money and we needed the money just to support ourselves. Yeah. But I couldn't afford it musically. So I simply stopped recording. Then I went up to Boston. And during that one summer in Boston that I worked around the entire New England area, I found the identity of the band. And once I found the identity, I said, okay, now I want to record again. Then I signed the contract with RCA Victor.
See.
And then, in the first date, I believe Begin the Begin was one of the sides. It was not. Nobody expected much of it, but But it exemplified or typified what I was trying to do musically at that point. Beguine was the kind of thing I liked. That was a musical sound. But the people, my well-wishers and advisors over there said, oh, you know, this will never get off the ground. You know, 8 million to date, at least.
You're still getting residuals from that, I'm sure.
I'll say.
Artie Shaw once said, there's no sense in my doing what somebody else is doing. I want to stay up to date musically, but in my own way. And that's what he's been doing for his entire career. And if Artie Shaw can attribute his success to doing his own thing, then Lake Compounds in Bristol can say the same. You see, just as Mr. Shaw set his own precedent for music style, Lake Compounds has established its own type of fun and entertainment. And at Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, you'll find fun for the whole family. This weekend, Lake Compounds, now in its 126th fun-filled season, will present special Mother's Day festivities. Kenny Roberts will be presenting gifts to the oldest mother, the youngest mother, and the mother with the most children present. Slim Cox and the Cowboy Caravan will be offering continuous free entertainment beginning at 2:30 in the afternoon. And for that Mother's Day dinner, Lake Compounds' dining room opens at 12 noon. And there's much more, this and every weekend, at Lake Compounds in Bristol, offering fun and entertainment for people of all ages since 1846. Artie, at this point in your career, wasn't it about the time that someone deduced that Art Shaw should be followed by somebody saying Gesundheit and suggested a change to Artie?
Yeah, I don't know who that was. Some genius decided that Artie Shaw was a better label. I dare say he's right. It is. Artie Shaw is easier to say than Art Shaw, isn't it? And I was just interested in doing what I wanted to do musically. So that was all. I was really kind of a fanatic in those days. We were traveling around the country with that band, and I was very bewildered and very mixed up as to what life was about. But musically, I was very straight. I mean, I think that was the most together I've ever been in my life. Mm-hmm. And people say happy, you know, are you happy? I guess I was happy because I wasn't stopping to ask whether I was happy. Like, maybe that's the only definition of happy. You're so busy doing something you like doing that you haven't got time to ask yourself how you feel. Maybe that's it.
You suddenly became a celebrity. Did your music change at that point, or were you able to continue on that same
path? Yeah, everything changes. Everything changes. I mean, I think what happens is that as you go from one place to another, the temperature changes and you change with it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you hit a room called celebrity, everything gets distorted.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about one-night stands? Did you consider them a drag? The traveling must have been...
Yeah, that was pretty horrendous. The traveling was terrible, but the one-night stands were kind of groovy. They were very free. You got out to a town, Wichita, Kansas, or Marysville, Kansas, or Sebago, Minnesota, whatever, and you got into a big ballroom, and that was your place. That bandstand was your turf. And the guys were friends, and you were trying to do something you liked to do and that you'd worked at hard, and it was a great sense of camaraderie and fraternity. And although I was the leader, this is before celebrity, remember, BC, I was the leader, but I was also a guy playing in the band, and they dug what I did, and I dug what they did, and it was great. We had a great thing going. Billie Holiday, get up and sing. Again, you see, you talk about civil rights. Billie was in that band. This was long before black-white became an issue. I mean, it was such an issue then, they didn't even talk about it. And when I first hired her, it wasn't black-white. She was the best singer I could get. So I hired her. I tried everything else. And finally, I said, gee, I want Billy's the only one who can make it with this band. They said, but she's black. She's colored. She's a Negro, whatever the word was. Said, what do you mean she's black? No, listen. Close your eyes and listen. Well, so we hired her. And we even went down south with her. I was nuts. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't realize we could get lynched down there. Came close to it one night. Terrible story. But the point I'm making still... Did I enjoy one night? Yeah, there were freedom, total freedom. Even Billy on the bandstand was totally free. Off the stand, murder.
Yeah.
But on the stand, total freedom. She sang what she thought she should sing. We played what we thought we should play. Nobody mattered.
Any old thing you do, I'll see you through.
Time,
that was my song, my lyric. Oh, I wrote it for her.
Tremendous.
I arranged it. That was, every note was mine. That was like, that was my little tribute to Billy.
Tremendous.
She loved
recording.
The tune.
In the early 1800s, a young America was growing, and an enterprising young artisan named Lambert Hitchcock was growing with it. His contribution to an expanding America was the advancement of furniture output methods, from the limited productivity of individual craftsmen to primitive mass production. In 1826, Hitchcock chose a small northern Connecticut settlement as the site for a factory famed for chairs stenciled with his name. Today, the quaint, historic factory still stands, nestled on the picturesque banks of the Farmington River. Surviving, too, is Lambert Hitchcock's legacy of quality design and manufacturing. Master craftsmen at work in the restored Hitchcock retail showroom adapt the old Hitchcock flavors to authentic modern reproductions. The Hitchcock retail showroom displays 125 styles of furniture, including chairs, tables, benches, mirrors, headboards, and chests. Choose from 13 different finishes and a variety of lovely colors. Visit the showroom and discover the timeless beauty of Hitchcock, designs of yesteryear for today's homemakers. That's the Hitchcock retail showroom, Riverton, Connecticut. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5, Wednesday evenings till 9. Now back to November 28th of 1939. Artie Shaw's orchestra appearing at the Café Rouge of Hotel Pennsylvania. And this broadcast recording of Man from Mars. Artie Shaw, 1939, and The Man from Mars. Artie, what about the importance of those network radio broadcasts?
Broadcasts were where it was at, like television today. Mm-hmm. You hit your national audience with that. In other words, if you wanted to be known by a national audience, if you wanted to play for the United States rather than, say, New Haven or Hartford, you had to be on the air, just as today you have to be on the air, or a record could make you. It's one or the other. But you're getting out of the local syndrome into the large stream, into the mainstream. So yes, broadcasts are terribly important. There was a little constraint there. There was that constraint of the stopwatch. But within the limits of the 3.5 minutes or the 4 minutes or 2 minutes that you allotted for any given thing, you could do precisely what you want to do. I mean,
you were
I was
free to try
charge.
New things.
Yeah, it was total freedom. Mm-hmm. But freedom within a straitjacket, a rigid straitjacket. That's a hard concept for most people to understand. But freedom within a straitjacket is about all you've got in the world. All of us are in a cage, only some of us, the bars are so far away we don't see them. Maybe that's the only answer, to look for a way to push the bars out of sight. But they're there.
You had an unprecedented guarantee, unprecedented at the time, from Bluebird, incidentally, a 2-year guarantee of $100,000.
I also had the highest royalty rate at that time that they were capable of paying.
Here you were in your late 20s, and the pace was becoming ever more frenetic. You also turned to Hollywood, I think, for the film Dancing Co-Ed at that point.
Yeah.
I came across one of the lines that they expected you to say, "Greetings, swing cats and alligators."
Hep cats and alligators, I think. Yeah.
And that
I
one
said,
ever
I
get
couldn't
into the
say
film?
That. I couldn't say that line. They said, why? I said, because it's not how I talk. And he said, but that's the way jazz musicians talk. I said, well, then I guess I'm not a jazz musician. So he said, well, you've got to say it. It's in the script. I said, no, I'm not going to say it because I'm playing me. And I know how I talk. I'm the best authority on me there is.
You're listening to A One-Night Stand with the Big Bands. Artie Shaw, the man in the music. Brought to you by the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut, with authentic early American reproductions to beautify your home. And by Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground in Bristol, offering fun for the whole family since 1846. And you are tuned to WTIC 1080 Radio from Broadcast House in Hartford, Connecticut. Bob Eberle, who rocketed into the national spotlight several years ago as the featured vocalist with Jimmy Dorsey, is returning to the ballroom at Lake Compounds Saturday, May 29th. Yes, Bob Eberle, along with Bobby Kay and his 15-piece orchestra, will be presenting a nostalgic look at the great days of the big bands. You'll hear Bob Eberle recreate his famous Tangerine, Green Eyes, and many more of his hits of yesteryear, all in the huge ballroom at Lake Compounds in Bristol, May 29th. And remember, this Sunday, Lake Compounds, now in its 126th fun-filled season, will be featuring a special Mother's Day program. Kenny Roberts will be presenting gifts to the oldest mother, the youngest mother, and the mother with the most children present. Slim Cox and the Cowboy Caravan will be offering continuous free entertainment beginning at 2:30 in the afternoon. And why not take Mom out to dinner? Lake Compounds' dining room opens at 12 noon. So take Mom and the whole family to Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground in Bristol. Artie, as I mentioned before, your schedule was at this point becoming ever more frenetic. You were appearing at the Palomar Ballroom, and at this time you were hit with a near-fatal illness, a strep infection with further complications.
That had happened in New York before I went to the coast.
Ah.
And then I was put on sulfanilamide. I was one of the early near victims. Well, I was victimized, but I didn't die, barely didn't die. As a matter of fact, my obit was printed at one point.
Ah.
In Los Angeles. But yeah, the pace was getting too tough and I was being pulled to pieces. I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. I had lost whatever wholeness I had. And I fell apart. Next thing I knew, I was hospitalized. I was unconscious for 5 days and almost dead. And they flew out some guys from Mayo and they shot me full of a new drug which saved my life. And that was it, yeah. Then I got out of Hollywood.
You decided to go to Mexico.
No, I came back to New York first, opened up the Cafe Rouge of the Hotel Pennsylvania. And then one night at about 11 o'clock, it had got up to here, and I just decided quietly to put the horn down and walk out and get in my car and drive. I didn't know where I was going. I ended up in Mexico. I guess I wasn't really altogether sane at that moment. I didn't even make any arrangements with anybody. I had a lawyer and I had an agent, and I thought, oh, let them scramble over the pieces. I didn't care. I just wanted to go away somewhere and sit quietly for a long time and think. And that was where I ended up, in Mexico. At that time, a little dusty fishing village. Nobody'd ever heard of it, called Acapulco.
Oh.
Just dust and a few sleepy Mexicans. I spent the rest of the year, I think I cut out of New York in November, and I stayed down there over New Year's and into January, and I would have stayed there much longer, I think, except I broke my leg. So I came back up to Los Angeles then to get the bone reset and all of that. And then when I was up there, I had to make some more records to finish up an old contract. And out of that came Frenesy.
Frenesy, sure.
Which was a tune I'd heard in Mexico. It was, you know, I used to hear it every night on the little mariachis bands playing it. And it stuck in my head, and I thought, that's a nice tune.
That was recorded March 3rd of 1940.
That was the first time I was able to put together what I'd started out to do, use strings and a dance band. The original one, if you remember, I told you I used a string quartet and a little jazz band.
Yes.
Now I was able to use the full large dance band, you know, that is the six brass and five reeds and four rhythm, plus a large string section. So it was about a 40-piece band. And this was quite astonishing at that time because we were booked to play places and we were supposed to have 18 men. And, you know, the bandstand couldn't hold more than 18 men. The theater place is going to... And we'd show up in these two buses and everybody, this guy's flipped out of his head, you know. And the audiences couldn't understand it at first, but gradually that band became a kind of landmark band. As you know, now everybody uses strings. Strings are part of the scene. But that was the first time strings were used seriously in a jazz context.
Here in Artie Shaw's apartment, we are surrounded by eight gold records. One of them is for Stardust, with Billy Butterfield's trumpet, Jack Jenny's trombone, and of course the Artie Shaw Clarinet and Orchestra. And we'll be hearing that one very shortly. You'll be hearing Artie Shaw as he sounded over 30 years ago, when the clarinet virtuoso and his band were thrilling thousands. Crowds of enthusiastic fans gathered in ballrooms across the country to see and hear the great Shaw. Tonight, listening to some of his music, you can almost feel the pulsating excitement that filled those halls. That same sense of a bygone day recaptured is experienced each time you visit the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut. Yes, the Hitchcock Retail Showroom recreates the flavor of colonial America with a delightfully quaint atmosphere and authentic reproductions of the era. Their vast display includes chairs, tables, benches, headboards, chests, lamps, china, glass, and beautiful gift items, and all at attractive prices. Grace your home with some of history's richest designs from the Hitchcock Retail Showroom. Stop in, and the warm charm of early America will welcome you. The showroom is open Monday through Saturday from 9 to 5, Wednesday evenings till 9.
Shortly after Pearl Harbor, you volunteered for the Navy. Did you, when you entered the Navy, want to be a musician, or were you interested in doing other things?
I got in there because I figured that was a war that, well, for whatever reasons it started, we had to put an end to it. I mean, there was something so horrific going on that you had to do it. I mean, I remember when it busted out, I was in Providence playing at a theater, when I was out in the wings while somebody was doing a dance or something on stage. Band was on. And I heard the a little stagehand's radio and said something about the Japs have attacked Pearl Harbor, blah, blah, blah. No one knew where Pearl Harbor was, really, you know. It was a Sunday morning, and there we were doing our thing. And this note came, go out and make an announcement. And the announcement said, will all servicemen please report to their bases immediately? War is about to break, blah, 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 you know, whatever. And I didn't notice how many servicemen were in the theater. We weren't thinking about that. And I began to think, well, how can I stand up here doing this? The next number was Stardust. Will all military men please return to their bases? And now, ladies and gentlemen, Hoagy Carmichael started. That seemed about as dumb a statement as I ever heard. So I turned to the band. I remember turning to Les Robinson sitting in the front section. I said, well, kids, better start looking for a job after the first of the year. And I remember his face. He said, what? I said, I'm going to join up. And they all looked at each other. The word passed through the band, and like that was the end of an era. You know, for me, it was the end of an era.
So Artie Shaw volunteered for the Navy as an apprentice seaman, saying he wanted to help win the war and felt he wanted to be just another sailor, but then concluded that his thinking was more logical than military. So he sought out a friend in Washington, then Assistant Secretary of the Navy Forrestal, and told him he wanted a band of Navy men to go on tour to the battle action spots. That took him to the South Pacific in the company of Claude Thornhill, Conrad Gazzo, Dave Tuff, Max Kaminsky.
Johnny Best.
Oh, yes.
Sam Donahue. It was a fine band. Yeah,
Gazzo excellent. Was another Connecticut man, the late great trumpet player.
Yeah, he was marvelous.
He was a
marvelous
fantastic musician, mm-hmm. wasn't he?
Yeah, he really was. And so we went around the whole Pacific.
You must have realized that you were hitting a raw nerve there or something. You were even mentioned by Tokyo Rose at one point, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I got a little angry because Tokyo Rose was telling the enlisted men. I was lying in a foxhole. We were being bombed. We were in Guadalcanal being pasted. And, you know, it was like, will you wake up and see the sun tomorrow? Will you get through this one? And then all of a sudden, Tokyo Rose comes on and saying, men, what are you doing down there? There's men like, here's a record by Artie Shaw. Artie Shaw is sleeping in the St. Francis Hotel between clean sheets while you're in the mud.
Yeah.
Oh, why, you no good. You know, there I was, you know. It's a strange story, but it actually happened. It sounds too pat to be true, but it's true.
Then, when you
I
came out
I knew
of the...
she was lying then, buddy, you know.
From then, when you were separated from the service, until 1953, you kept putting, well, various bands together, but you didn't do too much recording with them, did you, Artie?
I did some. I was just doing that sort of like to mark time. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. I'd had the music business by then. I didn't see anywhere to go with it. I didn't see anywhere to go from it. And about that time, my personal life was in a total mess. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, all of that wholeness, that togetherness, that being integrated and self-contained was gone. I was scattered. And the war had really given me a bad shock. I really began to come to grips with the reality. I'd had very little training to understand. And I saw that things out there weren't so good, and they weren't so nice, and that people weren't what I'd always thought they were, and that I wasn't what I always thought I was. And I couldn't put it together. That's when I got into analysis, and I spent a lot of years on a couch scraping out the inside of my head. And after that, while I was doing that, it was a question of supporting yourself, so, mm-hmm. and I was living in a manner to which I have not yet become accustomed. And so I put a band together, and I'd go out and work and pick up a few bucks and then put, you know, go back and try to figure it out again. I did a lot of zigzagging during that period. Finally came together, and that's when I wrote my first book. I bought a farm, lived there, yes. and did that.
When you put the clarinet away in 1953, was that for keeps, or do you play at all?
54 anymore? Was the end of it.
54.
Yeah, that was
and
the end.
You simply don't play anymore.
God, no, I couldn't stand what came out of it. I mean, it takes a lot of work to make a sound you can stand, and I told you about my ears.
Yeah.
See, that's the other thing. Your critical faculties outstrip your creative ones, and if you let that happen, you're in serious trouble.
Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you specifically about the Gramercy Five. How was that group born and when? And was this your own idea?
Yeah, again, it was part of the big band of the 40s that I had, that big band with the strings.
Yes.
At the same time, I missed some of the open space that you got when you played with a small group. So it suddenly occurred to me, why not take a small group out of the big band and do part of the evening with that? So I didn't want to call it a quartet or a quintet or a sextet, so I started using the New York Telephone Exchange.
Yeah.
The Gramercy Five and the Circle Seven, and we had the Chelsea Three, It was not five. The five happened to be what we recorded with. And that Summit Ridge Drive record was the one that took off with that. First use, by the way, of a harpsichord. I was really going for a lot of firsts in those days.
Yes,
but I
guess
this was a reflection of a kind of restlessness. Let's see if we can't do something that everybody isn't doing or has been done. Really, I guess what it boils down to, and I suppose maybe one could say part of the artistic impulse, is a tendency to get easily bored. I got very easily bored with hearing the same thing over and over again from me or others. And so I decided to try to do different things. That was part of what the Gramercy 5 was about.
Tangerine, she is all they claim.
Remember that one? Yes, that's Bob Eberle singing the famous Tangerine. And you'll be able to hear and see Bob Eberle along with Bobby Kay and his 15-piece orchestra Saturday, May 29th in the huge ballroom at Lake Compounds in Bristol. And it'll be a fantastic show with Bob Eberle singing his hits of yesteryear, such as Green Eyes and Amapola, and with Bobby Kay and his orchestra recreating the sounds of the big bands. It's a Kingsley Kay production, and for details, just call Lake Compounds. And remember, this weekend at Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, they'll be featuring special Mother's Day festivities. Kenny Roberts will be presenting gifts to the youngest mother, the oldest mother, and the mother with the most children present. And Slim Cox and the Cowboy Caravan will be offering continuous free entertainment beginning at 2:30 in the afternoon. So take Mom and the whole family to Lake Compounds in Bristol. We ran out of time so much before we ran out of material in our conversation with Artie Shaw, but I feel we'd be remiss if we didn't conclude by adding a few of his comments or impressions about some other people. For example, Tommy Dorsey.
Tommy was a nice guy. We were very good friends. I liked him. I was very, very saddened at his death. He was one of the nice guys in the business. No invidiousness, no envy. Tommy was a kind of crazy, bluff, outgoing Irishman who, expressed his admiration very openly, as I did for him. I mean, he did great things. Some of his music will, go on forever.
Oh, he had an extremely versatile band.
Oh, yeah. He was a hell of a musician. He had a lot of taste and a lot of organizational ability and a very hot temper to go with it. A lot of good stories about Tommy.
Peg LaCentra.
Funny story about her. She was from Boston. She had a Boston accent. And we were doing a song called A Fine Romance. And when we got to the place, I haven't got a chance. This is a fine romance. So I said, Peg, they don't rhyme. She said, well, I'm not going to say chance. I said, well, then you can't say romance, can you? Well, there it was. So we didn't do that song very much.
And Tony Pastor.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I didn't like the idea of the mooing baritone. Mm-hmm. That always seemed to me singing was like a lady's business, not a man's. So I used Tony mostly to sing the songs, and we used to make fun of ballads like Rosalie. Did you ever hear that record he made of it? It's funny. I thought it was fun. Jeepers Creepers. Those. Uh-huh. I liked the way Tony sounded.
Artie Shaw, the man and the music, the subject of a one-night stand with the big bands. Brought to you by Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, Bristol, offering fun for the whole family since 1846. And by the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut, with authentic early American reproductions to beautify your home. Our program was produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. Our location engineer was Ted Broussard, recording engineer Bob Schirrego. This is Arnold Dane.
So difficult to summarize something like this, Artie Shaw and the music business. Would I be somewhat correct and very succinct if I said you loved the music but hated the business, Artie?
Yeah, well, I did. I cared deeply about the music because I think most of what I did on the record would indicate that I was putting a lot of time and care and concern in what I was doing. But the business itself got to be too scrabbly and too mafia-like at a certain point. It's a difficult thing to be the kind of person who is forced to deal with the so-called practical aspects of life at the same time that you're trying to do what is essentially a self-expressive and aesthetic and artistic job. I think if you go through history, you'll find that most of the men who succeeded in impressing us with their inner world, such as the great artists and the great composers and the great writers, very few of them were able to cope with the practical day-to-day necessities of life, such as handling the bill collectors and the tax agent and all the rest of this. So this is part of my problem. It always has been. And I give off the air of being able to cope very well with my environment, but I really don't do so well. I could have done much better, and I might have been Lou Wasserman or Jules Stein. It's odd, isn't it, that the agents end up inheriting the world. The people they made it from end up trying to scrabble around and make a buck.
I'm asked so very frequently, what is Artie Shaw doing today?
The answer to that is the best he can.
Artie, your schedule is a very busy one, and we appreciate your taking this couple hours out. We've thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's quite all right, Arnold. I hope I haven't given you more than your station can chew. Try it anyway.